You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
The title of tonight's program, Finding God in the City of Angels, is taken directly from a documentary film by the same name, which is on sale in the lobby. We'll be screening excerpts from the film this evening as a way of establishing the sort of diversity that Los Angeles represents in terms of the multitude of faiths that find their home here, and as a way to introduce our panelists. Tonight's panelists, who are also featured prominently in the film, include Cindy Alvitre, a descendant of the Tongva, Rabbi Laura Geller, Senior Rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills, the Reverend Canon Dr. Gwynn Gibbard. Gibbard. I knew I was going to screw that up. The founder and president of the Gibbard Center, Religion Inside Out at St. John's Episcopal Cathedral, and Imam Jihad Turk, director of religious affairs at the Islamic Center of Southern California. Brother Satyananda of the Self-Realization Fellowship, originally listed as part of the program, is unfortunately unable to be here with us this evening. This evening's interfaith discussion will be moderated by Reverend Jim Berklow, Associate Dean of Religious Life at USC, and someone who has given a fair amount of thought to interfaith dialogue both here in Los Angeles and beyond. Now I'd like to turn things over to our filmmakers, who will also be joining us for our panel, the people who made the beautiful and brilliant Finding God in the City of Angels possible, Jennifer Jessam and Dr. Simon Joseph.
Hi, good evening. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming. And thank you so much to the Aloud series for having us tonight. Briefly, we had the great adventure of making this film. We were hired by the Institute for Signifying Scriptures to make a film about scriptural communities in Los Angeles. And the main question we were sent out with is, why do people do what they do? So it was an amazing adventure for us to go and explore the amazing diversity of expression of faith in this city. And as locals of California, we were both very, very surprised about the number and just the amazing fabric of faith and the different ways that people express their faith. So what you'll see tonight is a very brief excerpt of some of the communities of the representatives who are here tonight. And I did want to make a special mention. Brother Satyananda from Self-Realization Fellowship could not join us tonight because the president of Self-Realization Fellowship passed away Tuesday night. So he's in all of our thoughts, in our heart tonight. And but we'll certainly be able to answer questions about Self-Realization Fellowship if anybody has any. I do want to make a special thanks for the Institute for Signifying Scriptures. They very generously allowed the film to be screened tonight, and it was really their vision and their inspiration that led us to make this film. So there is a representative outside from the ISS if you want to ask them any questions about the Institute and what they do, and I believe they're also selling DVDs of the full film out there tonight as well. And I think the one thing we always like to say is that whenever we show the film, certainly there are a lot of different questions, and I think one of the biggest ones is, why wasn't this group included, or why wasn't that group included? And I think what we were able to accomplish with the film is to show just the briefest, the smallest section of the diversity of faith backgrounds in Los Angeles. And so for every group that you might see up on the screen tonight, or certainly if you were to see the whole film, there are many, many more out there. And I think, if anything, it shows us that this is a very rich place to have such a conversation about, the importance of the different faiths speaking together. So we'll look forward to your comments and your feedback, and I hope you enjoy the excerpts. Thank you.
So, everyone, how does this film make you feel about L.A.? Yeah?
It makes me feel good about Los Angeles. Really good. Question for our filmmakers to start with. I know that the topic of this film was about scriptures. Yes? Where did that topic come from? I know the Institute for Signifying Scriptures is at Claremont. Simon, right. maybe you could say a little bit more about that?
The film really began as an investigation into what the different religious traditions, how they treat the practice, the phenomenon of scriptures. So it became very apparent early on that an almost universal phenomena in religious traditions is the composition of scriptures. So that's really how the film got started.
And I think even I would just add to that that our definition of scripture expanded right away, because certainly with the indigenous traditions and a lot of Eastern traditions, there really isn't what we would call scripture, a written tradition. But every community had something that guided them, that gave them a sense of purpose, maybe, or a sense of identity. Maybe it was a roadmap. Maybe it was something. So whether it was actually a written text, or maybe it was an expression of art or some type of devotional practice, our definition of scripture quickly expanded to meet those needs, and that's something very much that the Institute is focused on, the work that they do there.
What struck me about the film, well, I just watched it, I think, for the third time, or a piece of it this time. Every time I weep at the part that gets me teared up is the devotional spirituality that's expressed in it, particularly your studio shots, the kind of the pieces of it that had the black background. Those really, really get me going, just because you can feel the devotion, feel the bhakti, that spirituality, and that it strikes me, really, quite frankly, that's what holds the film together more than anything else, is that, you know, very deep, heartfelt connection with the divine that comes out in the faith practices of these different traditions that you highlight. So it's just that, to me, that's what makes it. It's just a thing of beauty, and it's a spiritual experience to watch. Buy it. This is a good thing. Just for that, you'll have not only are you going to learn about Los Angeles' religious tradition, but you'll also get a really profound sense of what brings us together, I think, across faiths, that devotional energy. I don't know, do you have any comments about, was that a surprise to you about how that strongly that came through, or is that just a natural outgrowth of this process?
I think actually that was something we chose to focus on, uh-huh. is that, you know, certainly we wanted to respect the amazing diversity of practice in this, in within all the faiths, but we also really wanted to get to the very deep thing that everybody shares. So maybe you have a different ideology or a different cosmology than somebody, but all the faiths share something very deep and very profound. And for us, that was a way to to connect into something very true, mm-hmm. that people could really, I think, connect with and agree upon. So, and I think that, you know, to me, if I said what is the importance of an interfaith dialogue, it's respecting things that give us all our own beautiful, unique voice, yet at the same time, there's something very deep and profound that connects us. And I think that was really a very strong intention for us right off the bat.
Yeah.
And of course, we would say that we owe a huge debt of gratitude for each of the panelists here and their communities, their respective communities, for allowing us access, you know, to some of these traditions and the experiences, because without it, the film wouldn't even, you know, wouldn't touch that. So.
Yeah, intimate access. And I think another achievement of the film is that it does not trivialize religion. I wonder how our panelists feel. I just think that is a tremendous risk and pitfall of a project like this, is trying to reduce religions to a sentence or two of what they're about, and as if that's even possible for any of the ones represented in the film, and there's so much diversity within traditions, and I think that you avoided trivialization, which was hard to do. So congratulations for that. It's really, it has depth certainly it doesn't even come close to describing the, you know, to revealing the diversity of faiths in the city or this area, but still, it avoids trivialization. That's great. But on this topic about you know, again, you know, the bhakti or the devotion, I'm using a Hindu word there, yes, a Sanskrit word, which maybe I shouldn't be using. It's which leads me to the question I have for our panel, and just about interfaith relationships. Do you think there's one mountain with many paths, many mountains with many paths up each one, or just one mountain and one path, and the rest are hills or valleys? What do you think? And I hope you know what I mean by this. And if you don't, ask. Wide open for our panel members.
Well, I guess I'll start.
Please.
As a first person.
Yeah.
Well, just considering that Mother Earth is our text, and I would say that as we look around us, that's your answer to the whole thing.
Why don't you back off just a little bit from the mic? That's good.
Yeah. That Mother Earth, the nature, the creations of a creator, are exactly what inform us as to who, where we are situated within the spectrum of spiritual existence. You know, there are many people with many different ways. That's the way I perceive it.
I'll jump in on that one. I think it would be fair to say that we would look at it as one mountain with many paths.
Yeah.
As the Islamic faith.
Perspective.
Yeah. Just so you know which perspective I'm reflecting on.
At least one Islamic perspective.
I would concur with my brother Jihad that there are many paths and that prayerfully the outcomes will be similar if not the same. Unfortunately, it's we humans that get in the way and stumble along that path with closing ranks around our beliefs and ultimately and often causing great harm to people of other faiths.
So I would use a different metaphor. That there's one God and different paths to that God. Yeah. And that no path is better or worse than any other path. Some of us are born into a path and it becomes meaningful to us. Others along our life journey discover a path that is more... that we can walk with more comfort.
Well, what we have here are four pluralists, I guess. Would it be safe to talk about you in those terms? A question I would have is what kind of interfaith relations can we have with people who are not pluralists, who would answer, there's one mountain, one path, the rest of you are hills, if you're lucky, and valleys, if you're not.
Well,
how do we have interfaith dialogue with people?
Well, I think in many ways, if I can jump in on this one, the each of our respective communities, I think, have individuals that reflect that.
Yes.
Exclusive truth claim position, but one that's exclusive to the point of showing no interest in interfaith cooperation or dialogue or civic engagement. So. I really think that that's the work of intrafaith dialogue. So that, and I heard when Dr. Gibord was speaking about Christianity, one of the things I appreciated about her presentation was the introspective, so, you know, critical analysis of her own tradition, and we as well do that within our ranks. And there's a discussion that's authentic to the Islamic tradition that. That challenges those who take a harsh point of view or take a point of view. I mean, let's just be frank. Well, you know, people are probably wondering why Muslims all want to blow everyone up. It's the point of view that challenges those who would want to do harm to the world, and we're very much engaged in a rigorous debate. I think our challenge as a community is really that we're not heard speaking on our own behalf, the only members of our community that get airtime on news channels are the most radical extreme. And I think other traditions sometimes face that challenge and the way the Catholic Church is portrayed. And, you know, religion in general in modern media doesn't get that depth that this film portrays. But so our challenge is being heard in our own voice. And I would say that on the intra-faith level, we are to challenge. We have a moral responsibility to challenge those who, through the human filter, manipulate scripture, the divine, or put God in a box, etc., and really are just reflecting their own idiosyncratic understanding of the world. And in regards to the interfaith community, our responsibility is to not try and convert the world or impose anything on anyone, but rather to simply be known for who you are and to listen to who other people are around you so that you can find that area, those areas of commonality and work for the common good. So that's how I sort of see what our mandate is as faith communities here in Los Angeles and around the world.
I think there's a difference between dialogue and working together.
Yeah.
Over the years, I've been involved in many different interfaith dialogues, and I find them interesting, and I learn a lot. But ultimately, what's the value? The value is simply getting to know other people and other points of view. I've discovered over the years that while we can talk together, often we can't pray together, and that's fine. But I think we can do work together. Mm-hmm. So an example, there's a member of my congregation here, Deborah Corno, hi, who is chairing an effort in the congregation called Imagine LA. Imagine LA, which is a vision of responding to homelessness, homeless families in the city of Los Angeles. Apparently there are 8,000 homeless families in Los Angeles. There are apparently 8,000 faith communities in Los Angeles. So the idea of Imagine LA is that if every congregation adopted just one family and really helped that family make the transition from homelessness to, you know, having a home and a job and the support that the family needs, we could, as a faith community, overcome homelessness. So you don't have to agree with another faith community to do that work. You don't even have to pray together or even talk much about, you know, doctrine and how you understand what it means to be a religious person. But together we can do that kind of work. So I think that's one example of the difference between dialogue and actually working together.
I don't think that the two have to be exclusive of one another. It's been my experience that what makes it possible to do a project like Imagine LA or be involved with an organization like Housing Works, which creates affordable housing for low-income families, mostly women and children, is that one develops the relationship. And often the relationships take time to build trust and to see where there is an affiliation with the other. And that sometimes comes from, often comes from the willingness to be in dialogue, and it does take time. My experience often has been that it's a couple of steps forward and something will happen and it's a step back. As long as the dialogue or the work together keeps moving geometrically forward, then it's a very positive and good thing.
Question: how have you folks grown in your own faith tradition, spiritual tradition, through intimate contact with people of other faith traditions at a very personal level, just you as individuals?
I didn't really get to respond to that last
question. Please. Oh, I'm sorry. Please
and
do.
I guess I'll just, yeah, I wanted to, and I do concur with what many have said here, and it does require beyond activism and into action and beyond orthodoxy this simple belief that because I believe it's okay, into orthopraxy, which is very much what indigenous practices are. It's not who you believe in or what you believe. It's how you live and how you practice the ceremonies you participate in. And it's very interesting, and I wanted to make an exceptional note here because you rarely will see in an interfaith dialogue an indigenous person. And you have to ask why that is. Mm-hmm. And we've never been legitimized as an official religion, because people have a lack of understanding, and that understanding will only come about through the process of dialogue, through this inclusiveness and being called to the table to have a voice, because there is a lot of influence. I mean, and just leading into your next question, absolutely, it was only until I was able to bump out of my community and into other communities who are religious communities, spiritual communities, that I'm able to reflect back on myself. Uh-huh. Because when you step outside of yourself, you've lost your sense of comfort of who you are. You've lost that support. And suddenly, you have to listen. You have to be open. You have to embrace. And we certainly at a time right now when we should be moving beyond tolerance, that this should be a time of acceptance and more importantly of getting to know each other. You know, and as First People here, obviously, as I sit here in the land of my ancestors, and one of the very few of a couple hundred of us left who still practice our religious beliefs, that can be a very difficult place to be, you know. So you're challenged with anger and hatred, you know, mm-hmm. and been able to move beyond that. We have a lot. So it's important that we're brought to the table, that we extend these conceptions and perceptions of what is religion and what is a congregation and what is legitimate and what is not legitimate, because we have way too many people to accept that as being locked in a box.
We'll get to my other, amen, yeah. Before we get into the question I asked before, is a comment, and as maybe Cindy, LA is moving in your direction, and the whole country, because we're now at, we keep track of these statistics in our office because it matters to us at USC. We're now at 23% of young people between 18 and 29 have no religious affiliation. That doesn't mean they're not interested in spirituality. On the contrary, they're very interested in spirituality, we find in our university. They just don't have a particular affiliation. So we're starting to get a trend toward maybe something more like indigenous religion, if you will, where it's not thought of as religion per se, but as a part of one's way of life. And I don't know if that's, you know, those of us like myself who have affiliations with religious institutions can have mixed feelings about this, but who knows? Maybe it's headed back to the Tongva way.
It's all the same. Spirit, bhakti, in our language you say eva'a, achma, our heart.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the same. It's all the same. It's just different manifestations of our Creator. That's all.
But back to that, others, how have you been changed, or how have you grown in your own tradition through contact with others?
Well, in my unique, I think somewhat unique case, that contact came at a very early age. My mother's Christian, my father's Muslim, so I was forced to really choose which path I'm going to take, and it gave me the opportunity to, having a foot in each tradition, to explore them and to gain appreciation for both of them. So what I, in my own spiritual journey, I found myself resonating more with the Islamic theology, so I ended up diving more deeply into that tradition, and then once becoming a leader in the Islamic community and engaging and choosing to engage and invest a lot of my time and energy into the interfaith, into interfaith work, found myself sort of rediscovering and reappreciating and growing and even learning a lot more about not only Christianity, but Judaism and other faith traditions. And as was, I think, eloquently stated, it helps me gain perspective and appreciation of what we have in common and also some of the unique features of my own spiritual path that I'm on. So it's a richness. It helps bring perspective, and quite frankly, it influences the way in which I read my own scripture and religious tradition. So
I like to think of it as a Christian, to use the term Christian formation, that it being in dialogue with a Muslim or someone from the Jewish community or a Buddhist, a Hindu, or a Sikh deepens my faith perspective when we're together and having a discussion about the Holy Trinity, which is a very Christian concept. And to be in discussion with someone like Jihad and have Jihad pose a question to me about that, I have to think in a different kind of way, aside from the catechism of the faith. I have to think in a very, very personal way. Mm-hmm. And it surprises and delights me when I find out that in the Holy Quran, to continue with Muslim faith, that Mary and Jesus have a very pivotal role, and in fact, more is in the Holy Quran about Jesus as a human being than is in what we would refer to as the Gospels. And when I go out and I give talks, I love to pull out the Holy Quran and read what would be the Lucan equivalent of the Magnificat, when Mary said yes to the angel Gabriel said yes to. The angel Gabriel came to her, and Mary said yes. To read that from the Holy Quran, which in my estimation is far more beautiful poetry than it is in the Lucan text, and then to say to people, that is from the Holy Quran. And there's always that moment of, you mean that Muslims believe in Mary, mother of Jesus? Yes, and that Jesus was a prophet. Not the last prophet, but that Jesus was a prophet. So sharing those pieces of information is really deepens my faith perspective. Nothing is lost. Nothing is lost in learning more about other folks. I just want to share a quick thing, and that is that Jihad and I took a group of folks on a pilgrimage to Istanbul and Israel and Bethlehem. And it was at the Dome of the Rock that Jihad said to the group, we were a group of Christians, Muslims, and Jews, Muslims pray shoulder to shoulder so as to not allow that which is evil or of Satan to get in between them. And I love the image of that, because in today's world, where there is, when you think of all the hot spots politically, many of them are fueled by religious fervor. Not all, but many of them. And what capitulates that is lack of knowledge and allowing that which is untrue to get in between us. And that, as people of faith, we are mandated as part of our own formation to not allow that to happen. And I think it's just so rich to let that continue, those roots to continue to deepen while letting the arms of the tree branch out to other people of faith and embracing.
Laura, anything on this? Any stories from your own experience?
I have been privileged to be have been a student at the Institute for Jewish Spirituality, which is a project that began some 10 years ago, initially to help rabbis be more in touch with our inner lives. And it is a program that focuses on meditation, silent retreats, very intense prayer experiences, the study of traditional texts, particularly Jewish mystical texts, and spiritual direction. Spiritual direction is something that Jews didn't ever do. I think that it's something that came first out of the Catholic tradition, where a person of faith essentially meets regularly with someone who would be a kind of spiritual guide. So for the past 10 years, I've been in spiritual direction with a Presbyterian minister, a woman about my age, who was once the pastor of a church that could be Temple Emmanuel, except it happens to be a church. So she gets the work and the challenge, and I meet with her once a month. And her task is to help me pay attention to how I understand God in my life. When I went to rabbinical school 36 years ago, it would have been unthinkable to have this conversation. At that time, particularly in the liberal seminary that I went to, the focus wasn't on where God was in my life, but on the mastery of certain texts and traditions. And it's been an incredible gift, and it has transformed me. And over the years, the Institute then began to train cantors and then Jewish educators and now Jewish lay leaders. And we have about 20 of our congregants who over the years have been part of this institute now. And the synagogue is changing because there are people in the synagogue now who are paying attention to these issues of interiority and silence. And so our prayer experience has changed. It's become more contemplative. So it's not only my own transformation through this project, through Eastern spirituality that comes to Judaism through this, through the spiritual direction, but it's also how synagogues are transformed when the people who are in the leadership of religious institutions are transformed. So that's one example. A second example is we're involved in a community organizing project called One LA, where different faith communities begin conversations first within the community and then across communities to try to understand what keeps you up at night, what are you worried about, and how can we work together to make change. It's a community organizing model that focuses on self-interest. It's not Temple Emmanuel going to another part of Los Angeles and helping people who are in need of help, but it's rather everybody identifying what's in our own self-interest and finding partners in other faith communities. So over the years that we've been doing this work, we were lucky enough to get connected to Bryant Temple AME Church, an African-American church not far from USC, and there was a period of time when we were learning together, studying Bible together, very different ways of studying Bible, and it's really fascinating when we come together and do it together, but also experiencing each other's worship as guests. The folks in my congregation who would go to Bryant Temple would come back to synagogue and say, how come we don't sing like that? How come we don't move like that? And I would say, and when I give sermons, how come you don't say, oh, go, you know, amen, sister, you know? And that experience, seeing this ecstatic community pray together with music, and music so loud that they have to put the drummer in a little glass cage, you know. Now we have a service one Friday night a month where we have a drummer in a little glass cage. Why? We learned it from Bryant Temple.
That's a wonderful story.
One last quick example. We're in a dialogue with a mosque, the King Fahd Mosque in Culver City, and we take our congregants to experience, learn from this church, this mosque, and we took our confirmation kids. These are 10th graders, and they come back to synagogue afterwards, and they say, that service is so short. How come our services are so long? It's an important challenge, right? So you learn important things when you are open to other faith communities.
That's a great story.
I just want to chime in because, you know, our experience making the film, we really weren't coming at it from a specific faith tradition. It was really, we had to have a very neutral palette. And I think two things that sort of popped out at me as we were speaking is one thing we noticed very much is that you had mentioned how do you approach the folks who are only saying, you know, your faith is another hill or maybe a valley, is that, you know, we had an interesting experience. We interviewed some people who were of a very strong evangelical background. And the very next day, we had interviewed some folks from the secular humanist group. And, you know, we could ask them, well, don't you think, you know, there are things about you that are similar? And their first response was, no, if you don't have my belief, you know, some people would say, if you don't have my belief system, you know, maybe this is wrong, or you're in one of those valleys you're speaking about. Yet when we would ask them the questions, the same questions, surprisingly, they would have the same answers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you can focus, you know, the media, as Jihad said, the media is so in love with scandal.
Right.
And what creates difference.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we can create opportunities to focus on what keeps us the same, I think that's really important, and certainly film can do that, art can do that, work can do that. You know, Gwen had a great comment when we interviewed her. She said, you know, we might have different philosophies, but we can all agree that there are homeless people. We can all agree that there are things that as human beings, and how is that humanity, how can that humanity bring us together? And Cindy also said something different. You know, we have a very, our panel tonight, we have representatives of the, what they'd call, I guess, the Abrahamic traditions, and we have Cindy, but there's also, you know, there are a lot of Eastern traditions and as well as the indigenous traditions that have in some ways a very universal way of looking at faith and you know, unfortunately, Self-Realization Fellowship couldn't be here tonight, but I think that's also another important part of the conversation, and certainly a tradition that you know, in the West we're very sort of, I'd say, Judeo-Christian, we're oriented that way, but I think there's a lot that we can learn from other traditions who have lived together for a very long time.
Absolutely.
Jim, if I could add one sure. Other, I think, moving experience I had is I was working with Rabbi Ravain Firestone, who's yes. at Hebrew Union College, and we were co-teaching a class on Bible and Quran study, or Torah and Quran study, to a select number of students, and we were studying common themes and how they were represented in our respective texts, and how we approach text, and it was a very incredible conversation that took place and that we witnessed and that we experienced. For those who were involved and for us as who were teaching the course, but as in terms of the impact, the personal impact on my life is that one of the students happened to be a student at Claremont School of Theology, and she was a Muslim student and graduating from this Christian seminary in chaplaincy. And it just so happens that that school, the president of that school and the board of trustees was starting to look at ways in which they can enhance their curriculum and bring in Jews and Muslims and other faith traditions and have a shared space so that this personal interaction mm-hmm. that we've all been enriched by here as religious leaders, not all religious leaders have had this opportunity and have been so engaged in interfaith work. So I was approached by the president, and we announced recently that we're actually forming an interfaith seminary where everyone studies their respective faith traditions, but there'll also be a component of shared study so that in an organic fashion, all of the leaders, the pastors, the rabbis, the imams, the leaders of other faith traditions, and we're looking to bring in Buddhists and Hindus in the near future. Not yet the Native American tradition,
no,
but...
I'm laughing about something else. You said that. It triggered an image of my granddaughter in my mind.
So, but to have them have that familiarity and that experience, that richness that we've all appreciated in our own lives, so that when they go out and become leaders of their respective communities, that they will naturally engage in with other faith communities. Because one of the things that strikes me about LA is we have this tremendous diversity, but that film Crash that won the Oscar a number of years ago, it showed all the different sort of ethnic groups or religious groups living in close proximity, but still having a profound misunderstanding of one another, which I think was the ultimate theme of that movie, where we would crash into each other and we would force to deal with one another, but we would have these deep-seated misunderstandings. Well, and I think that that's kind of...
The good news, I want to share with everybody here is that in our office, Office of Religious Life at USC, we run a program for students. We call it Sojourn, and we visited actually about half the places in your film. We take students around different houses of worship in the L.A. area to experience face-to-faith, if you will, the religions of the world that are right here in the back door of our, not just the back door, but the front door of USC. And what I've been amazed by, and I want to share with you all, is that basically you can barge in on any of these places anytime, and mostly they will treat you like a long-lost cousin and take you in. And if you go to the Sikh Gurdwara, for instance, on Vermont Street, you'll be fed a fantastic Indian meal for nothing.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the way it is at all these places. So, you know, you can make your own sojourns all the time and not be strangers and not have to wait till you crash a car into another car in order to meet
a Sikh or a Zoroastrian. It can be done now, and you'll have fun. And now, my last question for everybody, you guys included.
May I just speak to this for a moment, Jim? This is quick.
Quick.
There was a very important document that came out of Vatican II under the papacy of Pope Paul VI in 1965, and that was Nostra Aetate, which translates out of Latin into "in our time." And the document, as Rabbi Geller said earlier on, you know, it was unheard of for a Christian to go into a synagogue or a gurdwara or a Hindu temple and vice versa. Well, this document principally spoke to Christians being in dialogue with the Jewish community. Muslims were mentioned, but the whole thrust was really about Christianity and Judaism. And so for many, many years, that was the interfaith dialogue, Christianity and Judaism. Now the shift that we're seeing in the collective is the awareness that we are more than the Abrahamic family. We are Sikhs and Hindus and Jains and Zoroastrians and et cetera, and that it is incumbent upon us to be in dialogue with each other, to do those social action programs in order to be stewards of the gift of each other and of this planet on which we live. And I think it's been a very important shift in the collective. Mm-hmm. That we're branched beyond the Abrahamic family.
Question for all of you, quickly. Keep it brief if you can, although it's a big question. What does religion do to L.A., and what does L.A. do to religion? We'll start with the folks that saw the most here. Yeah, I've seen it all.
Doctor.
then we'll open it up for questions.
Religion to LA, what is LA? I don't know. I mean, I think something I really learned is that the word religion itself is very loaded. And, you know, if we were going to have a longer conversation, I would ask you, what is your definition of religion?
Because, the loosest possible definition.
And I think that's what we have to approach it as, because I think Cindy really hit on something very poignant, is that we tend to have fixed ideas about things. And certainly for me, you know, when we started making this film, we knew that we couldn't make a film about Los Angeles without starting with the first people of Los Angeles, starting and ending, because anything we do in context, no matter what our spiritual tradition is, really, we're all visitors here. We're all guests, and we have to look at we can't disconnect ourselves from the place we're at, and I think we need to look to the people who hold that truth in their DNA and in their spiritual practices, who really, amongst amazing, you know, circumstances, the few that have really held on, there's a truth there. And I think if anything, I think if we look at this amazing wealth of material, not just in Los Angeles, all over the world, there are people who hold something very true about our experience as human beings, whatever our faith is, that there's something about the marriage of spirit and matter that we are as human beings. And so I think that wherever you are in the world, certainly in Los Angeles, it's very important to connect to that and to look to the keepers of that wisdom to, you know, to inform whatever your faith practice is. So,
yeah, I love the passage where what's his name, the owner of
Bodhi Tree, yes.
Talking about how all the crazy stuff of America, you know, tilt it like that, and all lands in L.A. And I don't know, is that true? What do you think, Laura?
I think what religion brings to L.A. is a sense of community in a place where community is extremely difficult to come by.
Uh-huh.
Wow. I think what religious communities bring to Los Angeles is an opportunity to understand that what people are looking for in their life is meaning and purpose in a larger society that sometimes doesn't have a very clear sense of meaning and purpose. I do think that a real challenge for all of us who are part of face-to-face faith communities, however we define them, is new technologies that I think are really changing how we think about community. I heard a fascinating presentation by Diane Winston from USC, the Annenberg School, about media and religion and how social networking is changing our notions of community and how that's going to change religious community. What does it mean, you know, to have a religious community where services are a podcast and you can be at home and not come to synagogue and still be part of a religious experience? For Jews to pray together, you need to have a minyan, 10 Jews together. Can you do that online? Does it have to be face-to-face? What do we gain? What do we lose? How does religion transform because of these new technologies? If we see the technologies not as an end in themselves, but as a tool to create a deeper sense of community, what is that going to mean for all of our faith communities? I think it's an incredibly interesting moment in the history of religion and how it's going to evolve. The film doesn't deal with that at all. I think that's the next film, you know, how all of our traditions change and communities change because of it.
We need time for you all to, maybe you can answer this question. What does religion do to L.A. and what does L.A. do to religion? My own experience is this is a place of phenomenal religious creativity. You know, there's new stuff bubbling up all the time. We get to see it on campus. It's more like a little Petri dish of world religion, and you can see it bubbling there. So,
let me give you I'll give you a metaphor of what L.A. does to religion and what religion does to L.A. from an indigenous perspective. Two little girls, Kyla and Sarah, my granddaughters, who my daughter, who is of Indian and Eskimo and French mix, married a man who is of conservative and Orthodox Jewish lineage. My granddaughters are Jewish and Indian. Now, I look at them, they go to Jewish school, and they see themselves as Jewish, but they see themselves as Indian. But also because they're Nani, their grandmother also has relatives in India, my granddaughter gets it very mixed up. That's why I was laughing about what is Indian. My last trip from India, when I came back and I bought her little churidar, you know, the little outfits for little girls, she came out one day and she wore her beautiful little purple robes, her outfit, and she goes, "Look, Nani, I'm an Indian," and she started singing one of our traditional songs.
Fantastic. That's great.
The children have the best model for the future of what religion will do to LA and what LA will do to religion. That's where we need to look to, because the reality is we're all mixing.
Your turn.
I have to look at my granddaughters. Yeah. I love them. And my son just became engaged to a Japanese Buddhist.
That's a real answer to the question. Questions out there. Comments. Yes, up in the back. Sorry.
I just wanted to say thank you. I really got a lot out of the film. And I guess this is sort of a comment, but also a question. I'm actually a social work student, and what's really interesting about the practice of social work is that part of it is doing this biopsychosocial profile, and now they're really starting to engage spirituality as an assessment of our clients, which is really exciting for me because that's always been an intricate part of my life, and I feel like it's as huge as the biological, the psychological, and the social for people. And I just wondered, as we're, it's pretty new in integrating spirituality into social work practice, and even in our program, there's a lot of conflict about it because the minute you bring religion in, just the big R word, lines start forming on either side, and so we're really struggling with it. And I think if you don't have a more sort of interfaith perspective, that it does seem to get difficult to talk about religion and to be able to share and be open to hearing where somebody else is coming from. So I'm sorry about that. But I guess what my question is, how do you, speaking maybe to a social worker, how would you see integrating spirituality practice, you know, or giving me some advice as a social worker?
I have to answer because I teach in the social work school at USC. Believe it or not,
And I think the point you're making is a really good one. You know, how do you have this conversation in a way that's not sectarian? The good news to think about is that the USC Social Work School in 1920, when it started, had a faith-based certification program for faith-based social work. We don't have one now. Actually, we're working on creating one now, reestablishing it, and it will be interfaith for sure. So there's a way to do this. Others?
I think there's a difference between spirituality and religion, and that many people probably, I'm going to make an assumption, I could be wrong, but my guess is that much of the population that you work with have possibly been really wounded by religion. And therefore, there is that hesitancy to push back from it because it evokes bad experience of being told that they were wrong or full of sin or that they needed to do X, Y, and Z in order for this to happen. Set that aside and bring in the notion of spirituality. I think that most people are yearning for understanding their purpose in life and how they might be helpful in life, and want to be embraced by a feeling of goodwill and goodness. And toward that end, I think that what you can do can be very, very helpful. I would stay away from the religious talk because that's going to absolutely push a lot of people away. That's my advice. It comes freely.
Others?
Well, if I could answer that question also.
Oh, sure. Go ahead, John.
I recently was invited to speak at a class at Pepperdine. They actually, if I'm not mistaken, are incorporating that into their curriculum for social work as well. What they had me do is come and speak to the class about the Islamic faith and practice and you know, address issues and concerns, et cetera, at a practical and as well as a theological level. My sense was from what the interest was from the students is so that they, as social workers, would be equipped if they were dealing with a family who adhered to a particular religious tradition, that they would be informed as to how to engage that family if they took religion seriously, how that might enter into the equation. So I think the curriculum that you're working on, I think, should include religion, traditionally religious experience, sojourner kind of experience, if that can somehow, you know, some kind of curriculum that would in some ways have a chaplaincy light training, the interfaith chaplaincy light training for the social workers, because people take religion seriously. It's a powerful force in society, and it can be a powerful force for good when religion is done right. And when people who are engaged in social work understand the central role that it might be playing in some of the clients' lives, I think that can be an important tool in your kit.
Other questions? Yes, over here.
Not so much a question. In terms of, I'm very nervous, but your question about what does LA do in LA, I think coming back from, I was born and raised in LA, Cuban American. My mom's a Santera, which is the native Afro-Cuban syncretist religion, growing up supposed to be Catholic, reading and having read the Bhagavad Gita. It's about searching for truth that you find in your heart, and it's coming full circle to like sort of realizing that it is all the same. And it's just, it's my experience of that at the most basic level. Uh-huh. So I just realized everything is incorporated.
In your own life, yeah, in your own story. Beautiful. Wow. Others? Any others? Yes, down here, please.
Thank you. I'm a rock-solid atheist. I came here and listened to seven highly intelligent people, hoping maybe there's a little crevice that might change my views. No disrespect. I have a high regard for the clergy. I'm an orthopedic surgeon In 50 years of practice, I've treated thousands of patients from the most horrendous injuries on high-speed freeway collisions, gunshot wounds, amputating gangrenous limbs. All the prayers, all the holy water would not have helped those people. I was able to save their lives and restore those people to their families because of the excellent teachers I had that taught me my craft. You might be interested to hear about one of our cases. We had a patient in ICU. For some time, being maintained on mechanical ventilator, intravenous tubes, tubes going in and out of every orifice, and others that didn't even exist. And eventually, EEG showed brain waves were flat. This person was now dead. It was customary to discontinue life support systems after consulting with the family. And the patient's brother flew into a rage. He was a Muslim. And he said, absolutely not. This is forbidden by the Quran. Well, this is a difficult situation. So we did what the bioethics committee usually does in such circumstances. We called in a member of the patient's clergy. And we contacted the local mosque. They sent an imam. He listened to the medical situation, heard the brother ranting, raving. He calmed him down. He says, wait a minute, you're mistaken. There's nothing like that in the Quran whatsoever. Discontinue the life support system. So we were very helpful by the clergy, and I respect you, but I'm sorry you have not changed my views.
Well, is there anybody here who wants to, after the session, have a chat with him and try to convince him?
No, I have the utmost respect for you. Actually, just let me say briefly, because and I go back to what Dr. Geller said, or Rabbi Geller said in the film, where she said that the Torah is where the conversation begins. And we all, I struggle with the same thing, especially when it comes to religion. I'm educated, you know. But we all have a source, a text that we go to as we proceed in life, what guides us through. And those things transition. I mean, I think it's great. I think it's wonderful when people question these things. We have to in this very, very changing, very volatile, very tumultuous time in the world right now where religion is absolutely being challenged.
And I would say there's one God and many different paths, and one of the paths is yours. Very often when somebody says clearly that they don't believe in God, an interesting question is, describe the God you don't believe in. My guess is that if you and I were to talk over a cup of coffee, the God that you don't believe in is also the God that I don't believe in. And that's the beginning of a conversation. You know, I don't believe that prayer, when I pray, I don't believe I'm changing God. I don't even believe that God is paying particular attention to me, Laura. I do think that prayer has to do with me and me changing myself so that I can be more connected to a sense of transcendence that I have, that there's something bigger than I am, and that my task as a human being is to be in touch with that and to live a life worthy to be in the presence of that transcendence. So maybe it's the beginning of a conversation, and maybe...
That's why we're having this reception afterwards, to have this very kind of discussion just with you. Others?
If I could weigh in on this
I'm
one,
sorry.
Actually, Jim.
Oh,
sorry,
excuse me for interrupting.
Well, I think one of the things that religion does as a general statement is it answers some of the questions that we have about things that we can't know otherwise, like does the soul live on? Is there a consciousness after you pass away, hereafter, etc.? For people who have strong religious convictions about, let's say, a hereafter or a day of judgment or a scale of accountability that's beyond just what the court system here holds us to account for, but a higher standard, people's passions might run high. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions, as was the case in this case of this Muslim individual who felt maybe fearful that by pulling the plug they're committing murder, and it's in the Quran. I think that a lot of people who want to avoid committing murder because it's in the Quran, or who commit murder because they think it's in the Quran, really have maybe a strong passion, but not a strong sort of educational foundation about their own tradition, or even a critical, reflective understanding of their theology, et cetera. And I think that education is very important. And one of the things that I think is important for religion to do, as I had pointed out in my opening comments, that I appreciated from Gwen's comments in the film, is that sort of taking a step back and looking at things critically, looking at things in a modern context, seeing how religion functions in the age of modernity, et cetera, and allowing things to grow and to the conversations to be at. In other words, to ask the questions and to not be afraid from engaging in doubt and speculation and, you know, to have those conversations and not to squash those conversations. So I think the paranoia around even opening the conversation or to talk about religion with other religions or to talk about religion within a particular faith tradition is a thing of the past. We need to sort of, in the modern age, look at things afresh within the light of modernity and science, etc.
Yes, down here, please. Just one more question after this. Thanks.
I'd kind of like to respond to those and to you. I'm married to a JPL scientist, so I have many years of having this conversation. What we've come to understand together is that, and I'm a co-founder of an organization around parenting and creativity, so we talk a lot about these things, that parenting is, in fact, a form of religion because everything we do is a belief system.
That's great.
No matter what you want, someone will tell you that the opposite is equal is true, and research backs it up, and all these things are a fact. Science is also a belief system, and there are many things that my husband bases his practices on that are theories still. They're not law. They are theory. And I think what this discussion is really all about is how we implement belief systems, what we go on out of our own hunch and our own intuition and our own internal creativity, and how we decide to form our lives, and that religions are really just manifestations of a community forming a collective language around how to identify particular passions. And I see science very much as the same sort of a passion. So I see them all as interchangeable. How we describe them is up to each of us.
Beautifully put. Back there in the green, and that'll be our last one. Hi.
Thank you. If any of you have been in past ecumenical discussions, have you ever seen any of the fundamentalist groups like Baptist Salinas or Pentecostals invited to your discussions? And if so, what was their responses?
To our four here, yes.
I'm going to be speaking at Saddleback Church on December 20th, and it's been actually the result of a year-long engagement with certain evangelical churches, Saddleback just being one of them. I actually had my assistant at the Islamic Center was a Pentecostal minister who ended up embracing Islam interning when he was a student at Claremont School of Theology, interning with me at the Islamic Center. But it was through some of his connections that we made some outreach. We engaged with some of the Pentecostal communities as well. So it's one of the things I had said earlier with regards to interfaith work is that there's really two fronts. There's the front where you sort of do intra-faith dialogue, and that's with those within your community and your faith tradition that are not so involved in reaching out. And then also it's important to reach beyond your faith tradition. So I think those of us on the panel are probably engage in both. With those, we engage in a discussion with Muslims that are closed-minded and not interested in engaging in who have very extreme points of view, and we try and challenge some of those points of view. But, you know, there has been some, in some communities, I wouldn't say in a mass scale, but there's been in some communities some movement to engage in a dialogue that focuses on what we have in common and working for the common good. So there's some hope.
As for our experiences, I kind of call myself a coyotist sometimes. Because coyote is one of those tricksters who makes the unhumanly possible, humanly possible. So creating a space for ceremony, for prayer, for interaction, engagement by communities is a place to experience. By renegotiating that space and allowing people to see what they have not been able to see transforms them in their own way. Examples of that is at Povungna, which is our place of a point creation of emergence, or point of emergence, and we do our solstice there. It's in the middle of Cal State Long Beach, been in a lawsuit for a long time. But also, I think a significant point and example is at the World Festival of Sacred Music, where we've opened and we've closed for those ceremonies. Nothing needs to be said. Nothing needs to be said. The contentedness of those people who are spiritually, humanly fulfilled will just, you'll feel it.
There's been an interesting phenomenon with the folks that we would refer to themselves as, I think the folks you're referring to as evangelicals, and that is, in the past, I would say, 3 to 4, maybe 5 years, they have become very interested in stewardship of the earth. And that allows an inroad to invite them to be in conversation and working toward that common end, which I think that all people of all humans, whether of faith or not, are interested in stewardship of the earth. So that's one place where we can engage with them.
Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.
I would just like to conclude by wishing you all a happy Hanukkah.
Absolutely.
Tonight is the second night of Hanukkah.
A happy solstice.
Happy solstice, happy Hanukkah.
We don't have any holiday this time of year.
Well, let me just add blessings of Advent.
And anybody who'd like to come to USC tomorrow night at 6:30, you can come for our posada. That's our Christmas procession with our El Centro Chicano, or Hispanic students, and anybody's welcome to that celebration of Mary and Joseph looking for shelter. It's a beautiful event. Join us for the reception just down the hall, and thanks for coming.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.